My dad, for the better part of, 20 years now, has worn a nitroglycerin patch. It's a heart medication, essentially. And I got quite interested in the idea that if you can deliver something as important as a heart medication through a patch, what else can you deliver through a patch? Close to the end of 2016, I'm living in Florida with Heidi, on minimal income and driving for Uber. We had been rejected by NASDAQ twice, and I had taken in some hefty investment at that point. And the pressure is really what drove me to make sure that we weren't going to get a third one. You're talking about other people's money now. It's a very serious situation, and it is riddled with pressure. I always just saw myself ringing the bell.
Really?
I could feel it. And I knew it was going to happen. It wasn't a case of if, it was more of a case of when.
The Nasdaq bell.
Now, yeah. We listed on the Nasdaq on October 1st and we got funded $6.6 million that same day.
Big day.
It was a great day.
Gareth, welcome to the pod.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on, Gary.
Welcome home.
Yeah, that's the other thing. It's great to be back. It's been a hectic journey, but it's like we never left in a way.
When you said, but just back, I thought you meant like a few months ago, maybe last year, literally a few days.
Yeah, we're looking at about a week now. And it's just been a case of trying to navigate that with a 2-year-old and a wife and, things that I didn't leave with that I'm coming back with that is new to me now. So navigating it now and processing it.
Where are you moving back from?
We've been spending most of our time last 7 years in the States. We lived in Salt Lake City. The company was based in Florida, so we were splitting our time between the two. And now we're back to sunny still Oregon. So,
What do you do?
Well, I started a company called Nutriband, which is a pharmaceutical company. And we're specifically focused on improving the safety profile of easily abused medications, not only to make them difficult to abuse, but also make them accessible to a very large group of people over the last 10 years who've had their access cut to adequate care and prescriptions. So it's a combination of both. And we're really the only company globally doing that with a specific focus on that now.
So what does that mean to someone like me who has no kind of concept of this? Like, what's it in kind of like everyday language?
Yeah, so imagine you have a very bad car crash with a spinal injury and it requires very hefty pain management, probably for the rest of your life, let's say. And the only real solution historically and even today for these types of pain categories is opiates. But opiates have had a very bad stigma over the last 10 years, which has resulted in a drastic decrease in prescription rates. But what hasn't decreased is the actual pain community who need adequate access to these medications. There's been a 75% reduction in opiate prescriptions since 2016. And people relying on opiates for managing pain has not reduced by 75%. In fact, it's increased. But what this has done now, almost fueling the negative focus on opiates, is that people that were getting prescribed opiates to manage pain were not getting prescriptions anymore and they started to buy them illegally. So it's fueling an illegal opiate system.
Okay. And what are opiates then to kind of break that down?
An opiate is, a medication like fentanyl, for example. Everybody's heard that word in the news recently. Fentanyl is 50 times more potent than heroin. Very easy to abuse, very easy to overdose, and very easy to misuse. However, when used correctly, fentanyl is a very, very strong pain medication for treating palliative care, cancer patients, really severe round-the-clock pain management. And unfortunately, it's had a very bad rap in recent years, like I said, which has reduced the prescription rates. But to give you an idea on the strength of fentanyl and why there's been a negative focus on it, which I think was well-intentioned, the tip of a pencil, the actual lead portion on the tip of a pencil, that amount of fentanyl, that size, is a fatal overdose.
Wow.
So that, to put it into perspective, the table we're sitting at here today would probably hospitalize the entire country. So it's a very potent, very strong drug and very easy to use improperly. In America, for example, when a first responder is sent to a suspected fentanyl overdose, in most cases, they'll wear a hazmat suit because there could be enough fentanyl in the air to cause a reaction. So it's a very potent compound itself, but if you look away from the negatives, it's a very, very effective treatment for chronic pain. So, you know, in recent years, we've had a system that has become very anti-opiate because of the negative stigma, because of the overdose rates we're seeing and things like that. But the real casualty here was the pain patient who've had their access cut to adequate care. You had people that were relying on, you know, fentanyl or buprenorphine or any other type of opiate to manage their pain, being told now to go take a Nurofen plus or extra strength and, you know, deal with it.
That seems like a big step down.
Yeah, and it's cold turkey. There's no winding down off your opiate. The prescriptions, because of the liability associated with it, prescribers were just reluctant to give them out anymore. So it became a system that was so focused on reducing abuse that everybody tended to ignore the pain population who relied on the drug, and it created a massive disconnect.
How did you get into this? That's such a specific problem. How did you start this?
I started the company in 2012 in my final year of college. It was originally a thesis idea. And I started it, you know, maybe at the expense of my grades. You know, I'm a 2-2 graduate. There's no great story to come from my college years. But my dad, for the better part of, you know, 20 years now, has worn a nitroglycerin patch, which is a patch used to, it's a heart medication, essentially.
Okay.
And I got quite interested, you know, in the idea that if you can deliver something as important as a heart medication through a patch, then obviously the technology is strong enough that people rely on that. What else can you deliver through a patch?
What were you studying?
I was studying business and management in DIT.
Oh, I thought you were going to say like pharmacy or like biology or something.
No,
okay.
No pharma background, no biotech background. But I have surrounded myself with, you know, people who I would classify as the best in the world in their space. And that was something I had to learn to do. I was very, you know, naive kind of in the early days of the business, and I didn't want to tell people what I was doing because, you know, in my mind, everybody was going to go start their own transdermal patch company and it would just be this big flooded market. And, you know, looking back, it's funny to think about, because I think once I started to share the story and almost promote it and be proud and talk about it, that's really when things started to grow legs and kind of head the right direction.
Thank you. That is the one thing I say to all founders all the time, like, don't be precious about your idea. No one's going to steal it. No one's really even listening to you.
Yeah.
No, and no one cares.
That's
so
it.
Yeah, you, me and you can both have the same idea. We'll go off and execute in 100 different ways. Mm-hmm. So like, it's great to hear you say that, because like, especially first-time founders, you kind of tend to hold it a bit tight. You're also scared. You're also scared to tell people, because you're like, what if they say it's shit?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what if they say it's a really bad idea? I'll be mortally wounded. Mm-hmm. So this kind of came from your dad then, kind of like watching him and kind of thinking, if it works for that, what else?
Yeah, what else? If it can work for a heart medication, why can't people take their vitamins this way, for example? Mm. What if people are, you know, uncomfortable swallowing tablets? You know, I was interested as well in the diabetes space, that maybe we could look at eradicating needles and using patches in their place. Now, at the time, that was a well-intentioned idea. The science just really wasn't there. But today it is. Today we're working on a product, you know, at Nutriban that would be able to deliver, they're called peptides, which is essentially, you know, the category that insulin would fall into. Today there is technology to be able to deliver insulin through a patch that needs to be teased out. And I believe in the next maybe 5, 6, 7 years, we will have patches on the market for diabetics, and we could be one of those companies. So it's interesting just in the short space of time, seeing how the technology in the patch space has even advanced, you know, with other technologies in the medical field overall. So
what was your first idea? What were you actually trying to get to market?
My goal was always to take it into the pharmaceutical space, but I was a business, you know, barely a business graduate, and didn't really have the knowledge or idea how to do that. So I started off with something I was interested in, and I looked at kind of health supplements. And I looked at the idea of delivering vitamins that way. Maybe you can get your amino acids that way. And came out of college, basically hung the business degree on the wall. And, you know, I started painting houses for my dad's company to fund this idea. It was originally my thesis, but I felt like it turned into a more of a business plan. So I did my thesis on something that I was able to do over the course of like a weekend. I think it was like corruption in Italian football or something completely irrelevant.
Nice. Yeah. What a swerve, literally, from like dermal patches to corruption in Italian football.
I think it was at the time with the Juventus scandal, so there was so much material online.
Yeah, okay.
So I was able to just quickly kind of put something together. And then I got really obsessive with this idea. I was going to be the patch guy, you know. I was going to change the game using patches, and people that didn't like pills or injections were going to be able to avail of this. But it was always to go into the pharma space. But I spent 2012 through 2014 kind of in a feedback kind of mentality. So I got some product, questionable product, probably looking back, made in China. And I got it shipped over, and I designed it with my cousin in Wexford, Alan, and he created some, you know, branding for it, and developed what was the initial Nutriband.
What did it do?
It delivered, well, it intended to deliver.
That's a very better question.
Yeah, intended to deliver vitamins and other kind of supplement type ingredients through a patch. The science was relatively novice, I would say. You know, I went to the University of Google that year, and I created the products myself, and I put together some formulations that I felt in theory looked pretty good. And then I went to my local chemist one day with these written on a sheet of paper, and, you know, I was in line, and he said, "Next, have you got a prescription?" And I said, "No, but I have a question."
No way.
Yeah. And I asked him, I'm working on something, and can you take a look at this and tell me, you know, am I going to kill someone? Or is it look okay? And he was like, "Oh, come into the back room. Let's not do this in front of everyone." You know? And he took a look and he said, "Look, in theory, everything looks okay. You're not using any questionable ingredients. There's nothing kind of iffy or off about it, but I can't go on the record and say that. I mean, I would advise you go to the medicines board and get some sort of an opinion on it. But, you know, I think the science looks okay, but, you know, that's as far as I'm going to go with it." And I thought, perfect, that's as much as I need. Nobody's going to die in my mind that we're going to get some product made. And we did that over the course of a couple of weeks. We got product shipped in from China. Didn't want to pay the extra, you know, I think it was $2,500 or something to get it from Dublin Airport to my parents' house. So we loaded up the family cars. My brother came. We just all went out and we did about 4 runs to the airport back and forth.
Classic, yeah. Have to do that. I think that's a rite of passage. Someone messaged me yesterday. They were listening to Amy Connolly, who was on last week, and she talked about like loading up her mum's front room with product.
Yeah.
And this guy messaged me yesterday. He goes, "Oh, it was brilliant. I was able to clip that piece from Amy and send it to my mum. Her front room is currently full of like cans of water." Yeah. I was like, brilliant. Yeah. I love that.
It's an old story that everybody seems to have, I feel, in that sort of
area. $2,500 is the world.
Yeah.
When you're starting off, that's huge money. Like.
Yeah. That was a week long advertisement in like a supplement magazine. So it was my mother's dining room, not the sitting room. But it was stacked top, you know, floor to ceiling with, questionable Chinese product. And my idea was to start knocking on doors and seeing if I could get it into shops. And, more importantly than anything, gauge a feedback from the consumer if they would rely on patches to deliver these types of things. And that would kind of give me some credibility that what I thought made sense. It wasn't necessarily to build a big patch supplement brand, because I always wanted to get into pharma. But it gave it a lot of reassurance, because the product did, you know, it didn't sell. I was making hundreds of euro a year, basically, you know, but people that bought again. It wasn't necessarily that I had a huge amount of people that did buy it, but there was a reliance on it, you know. And so that was over the course of about 2 years, kind of gauging that and trying to build it up. And, you know, in 2014, I felt like it was just not building momentum. So I started to enter startup awards and things like that. And the awards came with money if you won. And I thought that was a great way to try and bring cash into the company instead of nobody would have invested in it at this time. I mean, you would never have made a return, right? Unless you were looking way down the line and you had to believe in me, and I had no track record. So my parents, thankfully, they started putting a lot of their retirement money behind me and helping out. Oh. So I was painting houses for my dad's company. They were happy to do that once they saw that I was putting the effort into. They'd never really just hand you a check, but if they saw that I was really grinding, they'd support it. And I'm sure over the course of the 10 years or so that they were waiting on some sort of a return, there was times that they had, you know, negative feelings about it, but I never once heard it, which is a nice support system.
I love that.
Yeah.
They backed you once. I think there's a great lesson there for everybody, is that people will back you if you're backing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people have startup ideas, but they won't. And I was talking to a founder last week and he was going to raise some money, but he wasn't going to put money in himself. I'm like, dude, no one's going to back you.
Yeah.
You're not backing yourself. He's like, oh, sweat equity. I'm like, yeah, to a point.
Yeah.
But also, like, you have to have skin in the game. Because people, you know, if you're asking people to part with the most important thing in the world, well, time is the most important thing, but their second most important thing is money.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have that in. You have to be all in.
You do. Yeah. You have to look like you believe in it.
It takes courage and belief in yourself and your business idea to take the step to set up your own business. In the early stages, entrepreneurship can be a lonely road, even through milestone moments. Deciding to commit the idea you've been mulling over, learning, growing, and developing your skills, building a team to help you along the way, and preparing to launch into new markets. Enterprise Ireland is there for all of those startup moments. From providing advice and guidance to new founders through our startup network, to pre-seed funding and early investment, we're here to help you bring your ambition to fruition. To find out how Enterprise Ireland can help you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com.
Before we dive into today's episode, I want to share a game changer for your business, Azure Communications. When it comes to print and marketing solutions, these folks, led by CEO Jenny Johnston, are the real deal. Whether you need an eye-catching brochure, sleek business cards, or a full-blown digital campaign, Azure Communications has you covered. They're not just about high-quality prints or digital campaigns, they're also about delivering great results. And here's the best part. Just for listeners of The Entrepreneur Experiment, you can get 20% off your first order. Just give them a call or go online and use the code FOX20. With personalized service and fast turnaround times, Azure Communications will help you make the impact your business deserves. Trust me, when it comes to making your brand stand out, Azure Communications is the provider of choice. Check them out at azurecom.ie. Use code FOX20 and elevate your marketing game today.
Nostra, an Irish IT company, offers world-class managed IT services, cloud solutions, IT support, and more, all tailored to meet your business needs. So, whether you're streamlining operations or boosting productivity, their expert team is ready to help you. Visit nostra.ie or email info@nostra.ie to see how they can help solve your IT challenges today.
And, you know, it's not easy, but if you want to make something or build something big, you have to go down the not easy path sometimes. And those are hard questions that you have to ask yourself. You know, I was lucky. I was talking to my mother about it only the other day as we were driving. And, you know, I was curious. I said, like, there had to be times over the last couple of years where you were just really nervous. And she said, you know, we didn't fully understand it at the beginning almost. But I remember, like, you know, I sat down with your dad and we said, like, he deserves to have a chance. So we'll take a gamble. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. Now, thankfully, their initial investment has, you know, in terms of today, it's a very high return. And it's really nice to be able to say that and see that. But it wasn't without, I'm sure, some very nervy conversations and phone calls. And, you know, I'm sure every time they saw me call home from America, I'd say about 30% of the time I was looking for help with rent or things like that along the way.
Did you feel a lot of pressure?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, but it's a weird one. It's not a pressure like that's comparable to anything else. I mean, my old business teacher used to always say pressure's for tires, you know, and I know it's the old like cliche, but I really believe in that. You have to kind of use the pressure almost as a motivator.
Mm.
I mean, I had taken in, you know, some hefty investment by, and we'll get to the story, I'm sure, but we had been rejected by NASDAQ twice and I had taken in some hefty investment at that point. And the pressure is really what drove me to make sure that we weren't going to get a third one. You know, you're talking about other people's money now and my parents' retirement money. Like, this is like, it's a very serious situation and it is, you know, it is riddled with pressure. But at the same time, it keeps you focused.
Mm. There's good pressure and bad pressure, right? Yeah. Bad pressure is if your family member is very, very sick.
Yeah.
That's bad pressure. Good pressure is I'm trying to build something life-changing here for me and my family.
Yeah.
That's good pressure.
And others.
You step forward. Like, no one makes you start your own business. Like, so you have to understand that. I think there's a real, I don't really like it. There's like a real, the startup hustle culture of like, oh man, you got to be grinding 18 hours. You got to be putting yourself under mad pressure and you got to like be sleeping at your desk. I'm like, no, you don't.
Yeah.
Like it's a choice. Like there's periods of your life where you really have to grind. You can't do that forever.
Yeah.
And it's a choice. People always forget you have chosen this path. Stop whining about it.
Yeah. Like, no, absolutely.
It's good pressure. Put yourself under good pressure. If you're putting yourself under bad pressure, then it's not the right business for you. You need to look at something else. So 2014, you entered some startup awards. Any success there? What was kind of like the kick on moment?
So I entered Ireland's Best Young Entrepreneur. And I did well. I did well enough in that. So the South Dublin County Council route, that was my, you know, I got to the final of that and won that one. That came with, I think that was about 20 grand at the time. It was a huge amount of money for the business. And then I went on to the regional finals. And actually, interestingly enough, I went out in the regional round. But the person that I beat in South Dublin went on to win the national title and won 100 grand, and I'd beaten them in a previous round, so it was, that was really tough to take.
Yeah,
because 100 grand would have just been life changing. Yeah. Obviously, but it was good. It was good because it gave you recognition.
Yeah,
you
know, nice credibility as well, isn't it? Yeah. Like you, someone saying, "Oh yeah, it's a good idea." You kind of go, "Oh, thanks."
Yeah,
maybe it is.
Exactly. Yeah. And you get some media attention. You get in the paper. You get a couple of things like that, and
the parents are finally going, "Ah, okay."
Yeah, yeah. It's once they see you in the paper once, they're like,
it's real.
Okay, yeah,
it's real, something's in happening. The paper.
We're still not sure, but. And then we did the Bank of Ireland ones, and that one was quite successful. So I won Best New Product and Ireland's Best Young Entrepreneur
at
the Bank of Ireland Startup Award. Okay. So that was good credibility. That came with, you know, a nice award, but it didn't have any prize money or anything. That was, again, just like a newspaper type situation. But that's when it started to get a bit more recognition internationally. So 2014, I'd always say, was kind of the year of the awards. 2015 was kind of the year of growing up quick and, you know, navigating the sharky waters of international business.
How did it go international? Like what was the, how did you go from like the vitamin bands to like going international?
There was a company based out of Utah, actually, coincidentally, who had been told about what we were doing, or they picked up on one of the articles, and it was a mutual introduction that was made. And I started working with this company quite intensely, that they were of the mindset that this product would do really well in Asia, particularly in Korea. And they had a lot of contacts there and they wanted to introduce it to their network.
That's so mad. Dublin to Utah to Asia.
Yeah.
What was the product now?
It was still the same. Those like vitamin type products, but they wanted to add a bit of finesse and kind of update them and basically take the concept into something that was better, basically. And I started flying back and forth to Utah and working with this company. And at the beginning, it was all, you know, the relationship was great. And, you know, I was thinking, finally, we're on our way now. Still with the mindset that this would eventually become a pharma company, but the revenues you could get from Asia would help you achieve that. And so in 2015, I was going back and forth quite a bit. I ended up meeting my now wife, Heidi, that year. So that was another big milestone. And at the end, well, not the end, I'm going to say the end of the summer of that year, that company kind of got into bed with some wrong people that had convinced them to list the company publicly on the OTC markets with the goal of maybe a major exchange down the line.
What's an OTC market?
So an OTC is the name that is basically given to, if you're not a NASDAQ or a New York Stock Exchange, you haven't qualified for them. You're basically, it's like a lower tier exchange.
Okay.
Think of, you know,
League, the smaller League stock exchange. Whatever. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So you, it's,
I'll always understand football. If you give me to me in football analogy, I'll be like, grand.
Yeah, exactly. So companies that haven't met the threshold to be listed on a major exchange, who may never meet the threshold, but it's also companies who have a very, very bad rap. I mean, it's riddled with pump and dump schemes. It's penny stocks. It's, you know, it's kind of a mixture of companies wanting to do well and trying to earn their right to be on a major exchange. And then it's companies, unfortunately, like this one, who use it as a vehicle to do a pump and dump scheme. And basically,
Wolf of Wall Street style stuff, like the stuff you saw in that movie.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, there's companies on this exchange that do that sort of stuff. And, you know, it's just part of the, unfortunately, it's just part of the culture and part of the business. They're easy to spot. I can see them a mile away now. I mean, you can just tell by reading an SEC filing or something like that. So But a lot of people don't, and a lot of people lose money through that. So it's unfortunate as well. But, you know, I was kind of one of the victims, I guess, early on. So 2015, I'm still thinking we're going to get products in Korea. We're going to start generating revenues. I can really start to build this now in the direction I want to go.
So you had a partnership with this company now, or how does it work?
Yeah, it was an unofficial kind of relationship that they were going to act as a distributor, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. But I got a call then from, you know, the new management that they wanted to acquire my company. And I thought, brilliant. You know, business is easy.
Magic.
Yeah. Early 20s, selling my first company. I'll go start another one and repeat the process. And it was worth about $1.5 million.
Wow. So you were going to be worth $1.5 million.
Yeah. And I was about 24, 25.
Bingo.
So I was
made.
Exactly. Yeah. And I just remember thinking, this is great. You know, I'll pay back any sort of investment to my parents. I have $1.5 million in the bank and go start my own other thing. And of course, so I had to think about it and I agreed to it. And I said, you know, if the company grows like they're saying it will, this $1.5 million could become a lot more.
How were you getting paid? Was it stock?
It was equity, yeah.
Okay, so they were giving you stock worth $1.5 million. Yeah. Okay.
And then very quickly after we completed the deal, I noticed something like, not even an exaggeration, 8 billion shares issued from this company, which diluted me down to my 5% went to 0.00000, whatever it was, right? And my $1.5 million was worth maybe 15 grand.
Oh.
So I had sold my company for 15 grand at that point. Now, granted, it was still very early days, but I remember just thinking.
Still.
Yeah.
I would be in my head going, there's my classic Porsche 911. Yeah. There's the villa in Marbella. Yeah, there's all that stuff. Class.
Yeah.
You had to have been thinking that. You had to have been on a beach somewhere in your head going, this is going to be amazing.
Yeah, I mean, in my naivety, I was just thinking, man, like business is easy, you know? And then you get hit with something like this and you're just brought back down to earth very quickly. And it was a maturing moment, kind of. I remember being warned by, you know, one of my professors, Tom Cooney, who's, you know, I would have a mentor of mine, that once you start, you know, heading to America and you start working with these types of companies, you have to bear in mind that it's sharky waters. Like, it's not for the faint hearted. And I remember just thinking, you don't know them like I do. They wouldn't do that. And of course, it's exactly what he warned me about happens. And still,
what was your reaction though, Gareth? Like, how did you feel? Obviously, gutted, but like, tell me like how you felt, because I always ask people, how did you feel when you sold your company? Yeah. And this is a very different outcome. Like, so how did you feel?
Kind of in my naivety, I didn't accept it immediately. I was looking at it thinking, you know, there has to be a play here. Like, they wouldn't do this to me. You know, this is a strategic move. I mean, these 8 billion shares have got to be related to something else, and maybe they'll issue me more shares and it's just a mistake. And of course it wasn't. You know, not long after that, actually, and only looking back years later, I understand what was happening, but I was offered to possibly take up the role of CEO in that company with very little experience, very little background in my early 20s. And I remember thinking, oh, here's what they had in mind. They're going to issue me shares, you know, as the incoming CEO. It'll all work out fine. And, you know, only looking back later on, I'm thinking I was being made the fall guy.
Oh, really?
Because there was an impending SEC investigation then into that company that I would have been at the helm of. At the time, everything hit the fan.
Oh, basically. Wow.
So luckily,
this is like a storyline from Billions. Yeah. I'm in here now. This is like a billion storyline. This is wild. How did you even get your head around this? Because like, I don't think I'd know what to think here.
Yeah, it just makes you just grow up quick, and it kind of forces you to ask people for help and advice and guidance. And luckily, I didn't take that CEO role, because who knows where I'd be today if
Jail.
I had been at the helm of that. Yeah. And you know, one story that you kind of make your own luck, I think, as well. And a big part of what I've learned as an entrepreneur is that you need to put yourself out there. You need to network. You need to, even if you don't want to, you never know what will come from it. And I remember not long after that happening, it was like a rainy, you know, Tuesday in October. And I got a message from a LinkedIn contact that I had made in Utah. And he said, there's somebody might be worthwhile meeting. She has an 8-hour layover in Dublin on the way to Ukraine, and it might be worth a conversation or a sit down. And I said, okay, yeah, no problem. I'll reach out. And then I remember just thinking, I was sitting in my parent, or in my parents' house in, the, in my bedroom, and I'm like, I'm not going. This is miserable. It's freezing out. I'm just not going to this one. And then something just said, suck it up and just go to the meeting.
This was after all this had gone down, was it?
Yeah, you're still kind of feeling sorry for yourself. You're trying to figure out how to navigate, you know, the next steps. Like, and so I went and I met with this lady, Dina Liskovitz, and very eccentric older lady from Ukraine, had made a ton of money in True Religion Jeans. She was an early investor in that company and had made a small fortune. And we get chatting back and forth, and I'm telling her about my, you know, my business. I didn't really go into too much details on the negative. I just still, you know, I still described it as my business. It was just being held somewhere else right now. And she said, that's interesting. There's somebody I want you to meet. And I said, great, yeah, no problem. And so she introduced me to our now chairman, Sergey Melnik. And I remember having a conversation with him, and I was describing the company and what it does. And I thought, and he had a strong background in capital markets. He had taken companies public before, but he had done it right. You know, he understood how to navigate and do it correctly. And, you know, I'm telling him about the business. And then I kind of laid on Sergey that, but I'm dealing with a bit of an issue right now. I've sold it to a company who have diluted me down to nothing, and they're in an SEC investigation, and it's kind of just a bit of a mess. But maybe we could just start the same thing again.
Okay, is that what you were thinking? You were like, right, I'm going to park this now, take my losses, take my licks, and go.
Yeah, but he said, no, you need to go get your company back. This is going to be kind of a lesson. And he kind of pushed me to get it back. And he said, go get it back and let's reconnect, because I think there's something here we can work on together.
Why did he say get it back?
I mean, I've never asked him that exactly. He liked the name, I think, but I also feel deep down that it was kind of a bit of a test or a challenge to see if I had the resilience to be a partner to what he had in mind.
I like that.
Yeah.
A little quest. So yeah, send him off on a little quest to see if he come back with the treasure.
Yeah, he's the type that would want to see a show of strength and see kind of that you have the cojones for it, you know?
I love it. You mix with some interesting characters. I like this.
Yeah. You know what? I'm glad he did, because it shaped everything going forward from that point. I mean, my relationship with Sergey is great. At any one point over the last 10 years, either one of us could have dumped our stock and screwed the other one completely. And public companies, I've learned, is that there has to be a lot of trust involved. You have to, you know, enjoy the people you work with. You know, most public companies, it's either one person makes $1 million or years later, dozens of people make multiple $1 million. So there's patience and there's trust involved. And that's a hard thing when there's that sort of money, you know, in the conversation.
So how did you get it back? Like, you were, what age were you at this stage?
The stage, I would have been 25.
Okay, so 25, yeah. So still relatively young, didn't really have any resources now. Yeah. So how did you get it back from this company?
So the company had put in a new CEO who was there to restructure. I think they had settled out of the SEC issue. They were back on track. They were trying to, you know, build a reputation again and get things heading in the right direction. And they put a new CEO in, and I flew out to Utah and took him to lunch and explained what happened and just said, look, the decent thing here is to just give me my company back and we'll part ways and we'll move on. And thankfully he said, I agree. I think, you know, it's terrible what happened, and I'm happy to sign it back over to you, and maybe we can still work together down the line. And I thought that was quite decent.
You're like, you're half right, buddy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We can work together down the line. We haven't worked together since. That'll explain that one. But
That's a ballsy negotiation move to go, just give it back.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I didn't have anything to lose at that point. I mean, it was, you know, Sergey would be the type that go ask for it back. And if they say no, go send them a legal letter to get it back and, you know, go that sort of route.
Okay.
So we, you know, all of a sudden I had my company back. I had a big lesson under the belt and kind of matured. I felt about 10 years on a business time scale. And I was ready to kind of give it a crack again. And what I learned from that was a lot of things not to do as a public company. And so my idea and Sergey's idea together was to take Nutriband with the goal of heading, you know, bringing it back to the pharma space. And let's list it on the OTC market ourselves. But let's do everything right. Let's make sure our filings are correct. Let's act like a NASDAQ company, because our goal is to get to NASDAQ. And that that's what we set in mind, you know, at the end of 2015.
Interesting you weren't shied away from the markets. Interesting you weren't like, oh, I'm never to go near them again. I think that'd be most people's reaction.
I got obsessive with it. I loved it. And my brief taste of it, even though it was 100% negative, I loved just the atmosphere of it and the potential of it.
Okay.
So in that same trip out that I got the company back, it was Thanksgiving 2015, and I flew to Vegas to meet with Sergey, and he flew out and Dina flew out and Heidi came with me. We were kind of seeing each other at this point, and we sat down and we mapped out a plan to file to list it publicly in January of 2016. Oof. And we would make a crack at getting a NASDAQ listing done. There's a lot more naivety to the conversation. I thought we're going to list on the OTC in 2016. We might be NASDAQ the end of 2016. You know, try 5 years later.
Mm.
So it's funny how that meeting with Dina, had I not taken it, who knows, you know, where, you know, I wouldn't be on your podcast, I'll tell you that. You know, I'd be in a profession somewhere. And it's just funny how it shapes the business. And Sergey has his own kind of variation of that. Sergey almost didn't come to the meeting in Vegas on Thanksgiving, but his in-laws make a terrible turkey and it forced his hand, is how he describes it. So hopefully they don't
any excuse to get out of the house.
Exactly. So,
and where was the product at this stage? Because you'd done the bitumen patch. Where was the product at this stage that you felt it was kind of going to be worth listing?
My attention turned to the pharma space. It was not necessarily the product. It was the concept and the IP and the strategy of that. So, you know, we listed on the OTC, but there was a strategy behind it that really isn't taught in you know, business books. And I don't think there was really a precedent for, which is that we didn't want to go raise expensive money. And that became a very big theme of the company. So in place of trying to raise expensive money, why don't we list on the OTC? We'll have a trading stock, which has a tangible value, which we can then use to start buying up smaller companies who've developed good technologies, but haven't got the financial means to take it any further themselves.
Okay.
And that became the strategy for the company. So Nutriban was almost an idea and is today with all these satellite companies that we've bought up along the journey. So it's worked out well. The strategy worked. It wasn't really, there wasn't a guideline to follow. So there was a lot of trial and error, but in 2017, well, actually no, 2016, the end, close to the end of 2016, I'm living in Florida with Heidi. We're kind of hopping around Airbnbs, you know, on minimal income and, you know, driving for Uber and things like that to try and...
You were driving for Uber?
I was an Uber driver, yeah, for a couple of years as well, so...
While you were trying to get the company going?
Yeah, and on paper, my stock was worth, you know, millions of dollars, but there's no liquidity to do anything with that. I mean, it looked great and felt great and everything to look at an account that's, you know, had all those zeros in it, but it's just on paper. It doesn't mean anything until it's liquid, you know?
That's a wild story. So, like, paper millionaire, Uber driver.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember I used to love Fridays because UCF, the university there, we didn't live too far. And it was just a case of going from dorm to bar, from dorm to bar. And you'd make $250 that night. And it was, you know, you felt comfortable then for the week ahead almost.
I love that hustle, though. I love that grind of like, no, I'm a CEO. I'm not going to get my hands dirty. I'm a big fan of that. Like, yeah. I'm a big fan of getting your hands dirty. Like, even doesn't even have to be in that. It can just be survival.
That's it. I mean, it was that or keep calling home to my parents and putting pressure on them. And those conversations were terrible. But, you know, there was never a moment where they questioned it or said no, but you just wouldn't want to make those calls, you know.
How did you keep your belief, Gareth, like to keep going after like multiple, like we're only up to what, 2016, 17 now here?
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of knockbacks there. I think at many stages here, people would have went, I've kind of tapped out now.
It gets worse. So this is it's been smooth sailing to this point.
Stay tuned, folks. There's a big ending. Don't worry.
Yeah. I mean, I always just saw myself ringing the bell.
Really?
I could feel it and I knew it was going to happen. It wasn't a case of if, it was more of a case of when.
The NASDAQ bell.
Yeah. It was amazing. It was just like a manifestation, basically. It was just something I just felt would happen, but it was not going to be easy to get there. And so end of 2016, I get contacted by a company based out of Ohio who were doing something quite similar to us, but they were a private company. And they sent me some IP that they had. And I was looking at it thinking, wow, this is exactly the sort of stuff we'd be looking for. So I just sent an email back and said, this is quite interesting. I think we should have a call. Would you be open to talking about a potential acquisition? And he emailed back and said, we're open to the discussion. Let's get on a call and talk about it. And we ended up acquiring this company in Ohio. And the IP we got valued, and it came back and said, with an FDA approval, the IP would be worth something like $120 million was the independent kind of analysis of that. And I was thinking, wow, we've struck gold here.
So they developed tech to a certain point.
They had only had patents filed. So okay. They were provisional patents even. So the $120 million sounded great, but it was, you know, on the basis that the patents would be issued and you'd get an approval. So it was a forecast that they could be worth this, but you'd have to spend money to get there. It would take time. And
where do you get the confidence to like acquire someone's company with no cash?
Yeah, that's something that just, I mean, that was just kind of my personality, I think. Just ask the hard question out the gate. There's no point beating around the bush on it. Do you want to be bought or do you not want to be bought? Like, here's what we have and here's what we're doing.
And what did you buy them with then? If you're driving for Uber, you've no real tangible cash in the business. How did you buy them?
100% stock deal. We gave them stock in the overall Nutriban company, and they became, it was at the time, I think it was worth about 25% equity because we really valued what they had.
Okay.
And we were still waiting to have the listing cleared at this point. So there wasn't actually a value on the stock necessarily. We had raised a little bit of money at a value and we used that to value the shares that we acquired them with.
Okay.
And so we acquired this company, and I remember, you know, I was sitting in a car park with Heidi, and we were in an Airbnb that we had to be out of at the weekend because there was somebody already booked in. We were trying to just stay, and we were just Airbnb hopping though, U-Hauls, and driving around in a, you know, Heidi's old Lexus that had like 250,000 miles on it, not even exaggerating. It was a banger. And I remember we had to be out of the Airbnb and we didn't really have anything in the area that was looking good. And I just kind of turned to her. I was like, will we just drive to Ohio on Friday and live up there for a while we merge these companies? And Heidi was like, yeah, okay.
No, and he seems like a cool customer. And he seems like a very relaxed customer.
Yeah, I don't know how she's with me today, to be honest, given, you know, she was with me from 2015 till the NASDAQ bell, and that's when it was really bad.
So how far are we talking here for American geography? Give me an idea of how far that drive is.
Oh, God, let me think. I think we did it in 16, 17 hours straight because we didn't have the money for a hotel on the way or something.
Wow. Know?
And so we ended up getting, thankfully, a very small, modest apartment there, and we signed a lease for the year, and we just felt comfortable we'd be able to make those payments and this and that. But so this is 2017 now, we're in Ohio, and the relationship with this company just starts feeling off, right? And
you've acquired them at this stage?
Yeah, we've acquired them at this stage. And then we get, this is when 2017 was the tough, real tough year. So we're working on the business. We're looking at companies to acquire. I've kind of looked at 4P Therapeutics as our next acquisition, which was our best acquisition in the history of the company. And so I meet with Steve Damon, who's the guy that was the CEO and founder of that company, and Alan Smith, who is still with our team today. And I fly to Atlanta. I sit down with them and I explain. I have the same conversation again. Look, this is what we're building. We'd like to acquire you primarily with stock. We could possibly bring some cash on the table. We had an investor that said he would back it if we had a really strong deal. And this is what we're doing. And, you know, we had a little bit of a back and forth conversation on it. And Steve basically said, I really like your energy and your passion and what you're doing. And I think if anybody's going to make a success out of 4P, I think it's you. And, I hate talking about myself like that, but this was his words. And I said, thanks. I mean, that's a big, you know, show of confidence. And, you know, we won't let you down, basically. And I remember around the same time we were closing out that acquisition with 4P Therapeutics. We were sitting down in a Buffalo Wild Wings and we were having a couple of beers. And I, you know, built a relationship with Steve and Alan at this point. And Steve said, you know, where do you see the company going? And I was like, if we pull off what we're trying to do, I'm certain that we'll build a billion-dollar company. And I wrote it down on a napkin and I gave it to him. $1 billion company, you know, will be listed on the NASDAQ, and I wrote it down. And every time I have a call with him, he brings up that napkin now. He's kept it. He brings it in his suit, in his briefcase to meetings and
stuff like that's important though. Little totems, little like tokens that you kind of go, right, this is, they're important. Like,
and you know, and on my last call with him, he said, you know, the way things are looking today, he has no doubt that we're going to achieve that, which is nice because it wasn't easy to get to that point. And I think you don't get many chances in life to create a $1 billion company. So
I definitely think you don't. But what was your strategy here? I'm fascinated by this. What was your strategy of like piecing all this together? Like, what was your big picture here? It was to build a massive company, was it?
Yeah, basically.
So you could see all these different parts. He's like, right, I need to connect these different parts of the business to build this product to then do what?
We need to buy a manufacturer. We need to buy some a company with clinical research resources. We need to buy another company that had strong IP. This was kind of just piecing the parts and using stock to buy these companies. To give you an example, we bought 4P Therapeutics for about 4.5% equity of the company. And 4P Therapeutics is a 99% of the value today. The Aversa technology that we're developing was their brainchild. So it became, I mean, really, we could have just listed 4P Therapeutics, essentially, if you look at it that way. But that was the strategy. And it also kept us away from expensive money. You know, I'm able to retain today as a public company a hefty portion of the equity because we didn't do angel rounds, seed rounds. We didn't go the traditional route. And we've been very careful not to raise money we don't need. We don't need money sitting in a bank account at the expense of shareholders. And I think that's something that's hard as well. I remember turning down our first offer of $1 million and it just felt so off. But had we done it, we would have been a 20 cent stock the next day.
Wow.
So just little things like that. And that was, I credit Sergey with that one. Sergey was the one that was always hammering into me that this is how public companies fail, because they take in money they don't need. They take in bad money. They take in convertible notes. They just do things that is going to drive the stock down because people get aggressive shorting it.
I think a lot of companies fail that way. Not even public. Like, you talk to a lot of founders and taking a lot of cash early and to get diluted down and down and down and down and down. And then they're 6 years in, they own 8% of the company.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeez, that has to be a massive outcome now for you to have any sort of financial windfall.
Yeah.
But I'm fascinated by your model and how you think, though, because you've built a big company by almost like by Lego, by putting together all these parts of other companies to build one super company.
Well, the nice thing about that is not just the companies we acquired, but it was the talent.
Mm.
Like Alan Smith, who's our kind of our lead scientist, he's the highest paid in the company. He's paid more than I'm paid because we value him as kind of the cornerstone of it and the science behind it, and he deserves it, you know. That's kind of the mentality we have with the company. I've got a great equity holding in the company and I'll do well on that. But surrounding yourself with the right team and the right pieces, and it's not easy to do because your gut often tells you to go a different direction. I mean, right now we're in a position where I'm probably turning down offers to raise us money 5-6 times a week. I would say this year alone, I probably rejected about $80 million in total, and because we don't need it. You know, it'd be great to sit there in the bank. And I think one thing that public companies do, which is extremely harmful, is they'll raise money, then pay themselves their $1 million salaries. And then all of a sudden, they're a 20 cent stock and the banks own it and control it. And you're out of a job. And you might have made $1 million for a year or two.
Mm.
Or you can run it like it's a private company and don't spend money you don't have and don't raise money you don't need.
You definitely passed the marshmallow test of like not eating the marshmallow now to get two marshmallows later.
Yeah, it wasn't easy though. It wasn't easy, especially in, you know, when you're driving for Uber and you're turning down $1 million on a phone call that night.
That takes a special kind of sicko to do that, doesn't it?
Yeah. It was tough. And there was some, you know, but again, I credit Sergey with that one. You know, I said, there's a bank here, they're after offering us $1 million convertible note. And he said, absolutely not. We can't take anything convertible, because they'll just drive it down to a penny and then they'll convert, and the equity they get from that will be crazy.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So you take in your $1 million. The person that has loaned you the money will start naked shorting your stock. All of a sudden, selling shares that they don't have. So it's illegal and it shouldn't happen, but it happens. And basically somebody will sell, let's say, 100,000 shares of your company, and they're supposed to cover that short position in a certain period of time. But a lot of funds and bad actors basically just never cover it. So you've got phantom shares that's keeping your price down because people are selling shares that don't exist.
This is the bit I never understood about this.
Yeah.
Because, like, we've all watched the movies, and you're like, short the stock, short the stock. And you're like, what the hell does that mean? Yeah. And then you Google it, and you look at Wikipedia, and you go, I think I kind of get it. But yeah. I could never understand where all these stocks and shares were coming from.
It's the traditional method is you sell a stock at $4 because you think it's going to go down.
Mm.
The stock naturally goes down to $2, and you buy it back at $2,
yeah.
And you replenish the stock that you sold at $4. That's how it's supposed to work. That's the model. But what you see now is people will sell the stock at $4 and they'll never buy it back to replenish the stock that was sold. Or they'll double down and they'll drive, you know, companies into the ground, basically to the point where they go bankrupt and then they never have to cover. So they've sold somebody a share that doesn't exist in a company now that doesn't exist. You know, the Wall Street used to be about, I feel, companies being built and becoming great. And now there is almost a culture to kill them.
That's wild. That phantom selling. I never understood because I'm like, surely someone is watching this. I always had the naive view, probably still do, of like, you know, there's only a million shares in the company. You know, how can Gareth be selling 500 and I'm selling 500 and Ben selling 500? I'm like, Where are all these shares flying around from?
What you see happening a lot of the time is that companies will list and all of a sudden they'll be listed without their knowledge in Berlin.
Right.
So you'll have, which is outside of SEC jurisdiction. So you'll have shares that will be sold and used to kind of control the stock price from a whole different country that really has no answerability to regulators in America.
Okay, so it's cross-border, so there's all these phantom things. Like, it must be impossible to keep track of all this.
Yeah, yeah. But it's a weird way to describe it because I find it quite exhilarating at the same time because I love trying to find out who's shorting your stock and things like that.
How do you find that out?
Well, we have ways of doing it. We have shareholder lists. I mean, we try and, if we have a high trading day, we try and look at our, it's called a NOBO list, which gives you your list of shareholdings and stuff. And we try and coordinate it to see what shares have moved and what haven't. And a lot of the time, it just doesn't add up to the trading you see in the market. And we're thinking, okay, somebody's shorting the stock, for example.
So you can see who's buying, like big purchases, I assume.
Yeah, well, you can't, not down to the name, but you'll get it down to the brokerage or down to the fund and things like that.
You can see Fox Inc. Bought 10,000 today.
Yeah, yeah. Or we can see like a major fund has increased their position in us and you can try and make sense of it.
Okay.
But I'll give you one thing that doesn't make sense. On New Year's Eve of 2021, the year we listed, we traded the highest amount of any company in America, 140 million shares traded that day. And we had something like 3 million shares available to trade. So either every single share traded 30 times or whatever it is, or there was a lot of phantom trading. I don't know. It's up to the regulators to figure that stuff out. But we traded more than Bank of America, Tesla, Amazon. We were the highest traded stock in the entire country with only 3 million shares available to trade.
So what was going on?
Good question. You know, but that'll give you an idea of what you deal with.
I thought we were about to get a world exclusive there. I thought we were like, and here's what happened next.
I mean, we've had...
That sounds mental.
We've asked funds, I mean, what do you think happened here? And they'll say, oh, that was probably just people trading in and out, day traders. And we're thinking, a day trader, okay, maybe you could kind of make sense of that, but 140 million shares on a 3 million float doesn't make sense. You know, we put out news that day that we got a patent in Korea and it was the most traded stock in America. And we put out news that we got a patent in America and it trickled a little bit up. I think we had a red day that day. Like the fundamentals of how stocks trade are broken, I feel. I mean, I don't feel like stocks move based on, you know, how they're warranted to move anymore because there's so much, you know, what I think is going on is just, you know, a lot of...
Well, the GameStop thing during COVID, like that was just one of those things you're like, I think the whole stock market during COVID, we just kind of lost our minds. But like when you're looking at that, you're going, I just don't get it.
Yeah.
I just don't understand.
Short position. And a lot of the times the only way to get out of the short positions is that, and this is what happened with GameStop. If a company is short, they'll have a compliance officer that has a stress limit that if you go through that, they'll force your hand to buy the stock, whether you like it or not. So what happened with GameStop is that you had all these big funds that had shorted it to oblivion, thinking it would never go up. And then you had a load of retail traders saying, we're going to keep buying, and they're going to get forced to buy in. And then when they start being forced to buy in, it's at market. It's not we're going to try and get it at a good price. It's we have to collect shares quickly and we have to get it done now. So you have all these funds swarm in on top of all this retail attention, and everybody's trying to buy shares that basically don't exist anymore. So you have some, let's say the situation with GameStop is like, they're trying to purchase 50 million shares and only 10 million shares are for sale. So what's that going to do? It's going to drive the price up until everybody gets covered, and everybody has their price. I mean, what did GameStop top out at? Like 320 or something. But that's where it went. And GameStop, you know, today, you know, they're sitting on like 6 billion in cash or something because of that. And that's just, that was just somebody who spotted the kind of negative side of Wall Street and said, let's put manners on them.
Yeah.
And, you know.
But it seemed to revert back to like type straight away. Like it seemed like Wall Street just took back over straight away. Like they smacked them down, closed down Robinhood, and a lot of negative stuff happened. The Wall Street big boys got together and just put a squeeze on everyone else, going, that's not how the game is played.
Yeah.
It's played in this kind of like shady kind of way. And everyone just kind of went on about their business then.
Yeah.
There was this brief kind of like thing in COVID where, oh, it has to be honest, it has to be above board, and it has to be very clear. Mm-hmm. And then like it all just like went back into the ether. I suppose there's just too much money at stake here. Too many people getting paid.
Yeah. I mean, the funds and the banks and stuff don't like to lose. So that was quite evident with how that was all handled. But I think it shook Wall Street for sure, because it kind of reminded them that nobody's invincible there.
Yeah. You know,
the retail trader, they would have to really get together now in that sort of grand collective approach.
It was the perfect storm. Like, yeah, because everyone was at home, everyone's together, captive attention. You're kind of able to like mobilize the thing, whereas now everyone's doing the busy lives again. Yeah, now you can't get traction on anything like that because everyone's too busy like with their jobs and running around the world.
Yeah.
But it was a perfect storm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they made a movie out of it. So
it was actually very good. I watched it on a flight. I was actually like, I was like, this is class. It was actually a really good movie. And it's hard to make a financial movie interesting.
It is.
Yeah. And it was really good. So you started doing some acquisitions and kind of learned as you go, like Sergey Kamon is kind of like a chairman or kind of advisor to you.
Yeah, it's really kind of the two of us just running the business and bringing these other companies together. But 2017 is also the time when we had our first, interaction, I guess, with the SEC. We were doing everything by the book and we were trying to maintain everything positively. But we got a letter from the SEC in 2017 that they've opened an informal investigation into the company to check on things, basically.
Wow.
And I was thinking, this sounds serious. You know, the SEC is the government.
It does, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't like this, basically. And, you know, Sergey was kind of saying, look, it's informal. They could be just checking to make sure everything's fine. We've made sure that we're doing things right, and it's always been our mentality to do things by the book. We want to be a NASDAQ company, and you don't get to list on NASDAQ if you don't act like that. So that was our mentality the whole time. But, you know, they started asking questions, you'd send responses, they'd ask more questions, you'd send responses. And then one time I was sitting in a car park, and I remember I got a phone call, and, you know, I didn't recognize the number, and I answer, and it was, you know, somebody from the SEC, and they said, you know, this is Linda or whatever with the SEC Miami office. Just wondering if you could come in and answer a couple of questions. And I was thinking, oh, this sounds serious, you know.
What does that stand for, SEC?
Securities Exchange Commission.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what do they do?
They basically make sure that everybody is playing by the rules. So they make sure that the core goal of the SEC is to make sure that they protect investors. So there isn't false information. People aren't relying on certain things to invest in companies and it turns out not to be true, for example. So it's to reduce losses. It's to make sure that everybody's playing by the rules. And the company that you're describing is the company that you're working in, you know? And so I remember sitting in the car and I'm thinking, I was kind of, again, just a naive response. I was like, what office would you like me to come into? And she said, we're in the Miami office. Can you come in? And I said, I don't have the money to fly to Miami. And she's there, well, aren't you the CEO of, you know, Nutriban Inc.? I'm looking at your market cap here. It's $40 million. And I was like, yeah, but I mean, we both know it's an OTC company. It's, you know, I'm not paying myself a salary yet. And then she said, well, it's no problem anyway. We'll fly you down and we'll put you up.
Oh,
and that's when that's alarm bells
worse.
Go. I'm like, oh, no, okay, they're invested in it now. So, so I remember calling Sergey. He got the same phone call, and we didn't really know what they were looking at this time. And it turned out that they were looking at a statement in one of our filings we had made that we had in good faith relied on some experts that was in relation to an FDA disclosure. And, they basically said that we had an incorrect statement in the filing, and we didn't really agree. We thought because we had relied on experts that it was correct, and, you know, granted it was incorrect at the end of the day, but we were almost kind of cocky about it. I remember Sergey saying, like, Sergey went in without a lawyer because he mm-hmm. just thought, I'm just going to tell them what's going on.
And the honest truth. Yeah. Just tell the truth, it'll be fine.
Yeah. I mean, we're relying on, you know, credible guidance here. And we think it's accurate. And I didn't. I went with a lawyer because it was all new to me. And
that always sounds like the best plan, though.
Yeah. And we went in and we had our conversation, and, it wasn't pleasant. You're basically under interrogation for like 6 hours in an SEC office. And, a couple weeks, I actually came out of that interview thinking, I think we've cleared things up. It was a misunderstanding, you know.
Job done.
Yeah.
See you later, guys. Thanks for the free few days in Florida. It's good.
Yeah.
Got a bit of vitamin D in my bones. I feel a lot better. I cleared that up.
Another naive lesson, basically. And then we get a call, and the SEC basically said, we reviewed everything and we're going to turn the investigation formal. And I remember thinking that, I'm like, wow, this sucks. You know, that's the only way to describe it in plain English. This is terrible. I mean, we've done everything. We tried to do everything right. And the acquisitions are coming together, and the model and the plan was working. And now you have this in the background. And it got to a point basically where, they sent us a Wells notice and said, look, a Wells notice is basically a letter that they send to say, we're planning to sue you unless you give us a good reason not to.
Wow.
And you have about 10 days to convince them. And I remember looking at this thinking, like, this is a career ender.
Yeah.
Like, nobody, this is black. This puts a black dot on you for forever. I mean, forget about starting another business and stuff. Like, this is serious, like, now. And so with the last bit of money we had in the company, we were introduced to an excellent attorney in New York who was an ex-SEC enforcement officer, basically. And he looked at what we were dealing with, and he was able to negotiate a no admit, no deny, cease and desist, we're not going to do it again type thing. And
so he was able to interpret it and go, right, this is what this means. I mean, this is what they do. This is how they operate.
I mean, we were able to make our case that we weren't acting in bad faith, I think, because the stock wasn't actually trading at the time. We had no active market, so there was no investors harmed.
There was no gain. There was no material gain.
There was no material gain, but there was also, importantly, there was no material loss by anybody because nobody traded the stock leading up to that point. And so we agreed to a cease and desist. We wouldn't do it again. It was an accident, essentially, but we would be very stringent and careful. And thankfully, we've never had another conversation like that with the SEC. We have been very careful, and we've maybe gone a bit further in our opinions and guidance. But what we were facing was just game-changing stuff. I mean, the SEC had basically said initially that they were willing to, or that the initial lawsuit was going to be a $75,000 fine, which I don't know where I was going to get that from. I could never trade a stock under $5 again. And I would be basically blacklisted as an officer or director from public companies.
So you're going to be finished in the States.
Bernie Madoff stuff.
Wow.
I mean, and I was thinking that seems really harsh.
It seemed like a bit over the top.
Yeah, but we ended up settling it out for significantly less than that, which was, more reasonable. It was a $15,000 fine each, and we moved on, and we thankfully have not maintained a relationship with the SEC on a negative standpoint.
Okay.
We've kept our filings up to date and everything else, but that was a real... grow up. Well, that's kind of put hairs on your chest kind of stuff.
You've had a lot of them, in fairness.
Yeah.
We're now about to get to the good part of the story.
I have one more bad part. So, so 2017, we actually get into a lawsuit with, 2018, by this stage, we get into a lawsuit with the company that we purchased in Ohio, because there was a filing that had to be redone on the IP. And we noticed around one of the times of our audits that they had refiled the patents in their own name, which basically negated what we had acquired. And I remember reapplied them. Yeah, there had to be. It was a re-registration because they were provisional. There was a time limit that expired. There was some additions and changes made, and then they were refiled for an approval. But they refiled it in a personal name, not the company. And I remember bringing it up to them and saying, "Like, this is a problem. What have you done? Why have you done this?" And you know, they argued that, "Oh, it was a simple mistake." But we argued that we got them valued at 120 million, and maybe they thought they were more clever than us, and they could have both. You know, they could have our shares and sell and cash out,
jeez,
and then be left with the IP. And if they sold all their shares, they're very hard to retrieve. You know, so it was just a messy situation. So we sued to rescind the acquisition, and we got into a lawsuit with them for misrepresentation, basically, and fraud. And we, you know, it was another lawsuit to be part of.
This is a difficult game.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one nice thing that actually I'll mention, you know, it wasn't all terrible. You know, I married my wife, Heidi, in 2018, and we were facing the SEC lawsuit going into our wedding. But on our honeymoon is when we got word that they would settle. So that was a really
okay.
We settled
in the bright spot.
Yeah, it was great. So we're in this lawsuit with this company, and it ends up going on for years, basically.
Really?
And they defended themselves. Well, it got to a point where we went to court, and we were in person and kind of arguing the cases. And I remember the judge saying, you know, I'm taking this very serious. I don't like, you know, accusations of fraud. I want to see what happened here. And, you know, we argued the case that as we're sitting here today, we have nothing. They have the IP and our shares. And for whatever reason, I remember getting a notice that they won the initial outcome at the lawsuit, that the judge sided, you know, in their favor. And I remember thinking, how on earth did he come to that conclusion whatsoever? And our lawyers said, no problem, we're just going to file an appeal immediately. We can't make sense of it either.
This sounds expensive, Gareth.
Yeah, yeah. And this is any sort of money you're bringing in now is paying lawyers and attorneys. Like our attorney that we use for the SEC, for example, we're talking like 800 an hour at a discounted rate type thing. You know, I wasn't making 800 a month at this stage.
Jeez.
So it was tough. And we ended up, thankfully, winning the appeal, you know, on all accounts. I don't know what the issue really was initially, but, you know, it's put to bed now, thankfully. And we won the appeal, and we were able to get the shares back into the company. And that was after we had listed on NASDAQ by the time this all ended. So 2018 is also the year that we filed to list on NASDAQ. We felt we had built into a position that we were strong enough. We had completed the 4P acquisition. We had, you know, built the company into a state that we felt was reputable. And we were actually working, you know, doing clinical trials for other companies and things like that. And we got essentially, I remember, and it was a feeling like, it's hard to describe. It's a feeling I've never had since, and a feeling I'd never had before in terms of just like dread. And I'm sitting in a Hertz in Orlando, because we had moved back to Orlando at this point. And Hertz had a deal with Lyft, which is like Uber in America. That they could provide cars to Lyft drivers who didn't want to use their own car. And I was doing that. I was driving for Lyft in 2019 while we had our NASDAQ application in. And it was primarily down to the fact that our car didn't qualify safely to drive as a Lyft driver. It wasn't a case of wanting to maintain it. It was on its last legs. It was, you know, kind of, you know, rickety. The brakes were iffy. It was just didn't qualify. And I remember even going and blasting through a four-way stop sign one day with a trailer on the back of the car because I hit the brake and nothing happened. Thankfully, it wasn't on a hill or something, but it just, no response. And then I remember just driving very slowly the rest of that trip. But that's the sort of car we were in. And so I'm sitting in the Hertz ready, you know, waiting in line to pick up a car to go drive Lyft that day. And I get a call from our lawyer and he says, I just heard from NASDAQ. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, this is great.
Cancel the shift, lads. I'm off to the...
And he said that they're not going to allow your application go forward. And I was like, what do you mean they're not going to allow? We hit all the thresholds. I mean, we qualify. And he said, they don't like that you had an SEC issue. And they basically said they're not going to allow you to list at this time. And I was like, well, you need to go and argue our case. We've come too far now to right at the death basically be told it's not happening. we were back and forth and back and forth for what felt like weeks, and it was only days with them. And they basically just dug their heels in and said, until we feel confident that the SEC thing isn't like an ongoing problem with you guys, we're not going to let you list. So what we're going to advise is that you go away and you resubmit your application in a year. And I was thinking, a year?
Wow.
That is just a year. Like, that's when everything just sank. Because I was, you know, I had people that had invested. I had my parents. All these calls I was going to have to make.
So you were building up to this. This was going to be the ultimate payoff. The
everything
landmark
had come together, you know. Okay. And I was, everybody that had invested and taken a chance on us was now going to see a return. And now it was all phone calls I was going to have to make and say, we're going to have to wait at least another year.
Mm.
And that's, you know, I remember saying to our attorney, like, a year is really long to be told to wait. And my attorney was like, no, it's not. Like, stop feeling sorry for yourself.
Mm.
Just go and work on your business and
Hit that lift shift and don't be moaning. Jesus, Gareth. Like, I talk about body, business and brain in this because I think all three have to be in alignment for you to truly have a healthy life. How did you sustain your mental health through this? Because this is just grueling.
Yeah, to be honest, like, Sergey helped as well. Sergey was like, look, we'll just back to work, you know. Back to work is how he has an expression. He says, like, you know, back to the eternal struggle, the peace is just in our dreams. He says, like, he's all these old Russian proverbs that he throws in.
Say, that's uplifting, but incredibly bleak.
Yeah, yeah. And then he says another one that always sticks with me because it's quite fitting. And he said, like, because it was a risky business to undertake to begin with. And, you know, he always says that, like, you know, those who don't take risk don't drink champagne. You know,
that's a bit more kind of.
I'm sure they sound better.
A bit more Instagrammy.
Yeah, they might sound better in Russian or Moldovan or something, but that's how they translate to English anyway. And so we kind of just had a day or two of, you know, sobbing and being sad, sorry for ourselves, and then it was kind of just this right back to work, like, get over yourself, build, like, show them in a year's time, show them how far you've come and get to it. And we completed another acquisition that year. We acquired a manufacturing facility called Pocono. And they were in North Carolina, and that came with $2 million in revenue. And that increased our shareholder equity up to about $8 million.
Okay.
At the time that we resubmitted to NASDAQ, and we were clean. We had no run-ins with SEC. We had no issues whatsoever. We just looked like we were grinding. And it was a really good year for us as a company, actually. You know, we had some additional existing shareholders that threw a little bit of extra money in to help navigate it. And we just came out the other side looking really strong when it was time to resubmit again. And so, you know, our attorney was right. A year kind of came and went, and it was just something that you always have now that you're looking forward to again, right? You know, all of a sudden you're 8 months away, all of a sudden you're 4 months away. And so we resubmit to NASDAQ, and we're thinking, really, you know, we've put, like, look how what we've done in a year. We're probably two or three times as valuable now. We've hit all the, you know, qualifications. We look like we heeded their advice. And I remember the application goes in and the analyst comes back, and his response was, look, congratulations, guys. Like, this is really nice to see. Like, you know, I think you more than qualify, and we've no concerns going forward, and I'm going to recommend, you know, your approval and stuff. And it was such a good feeling. And then it was early 2021. At this stage, it was early 2021 when we had resubmitted, and we were waiting, you know, for basically the green light, and kind of days turned into weeks, into a month. And I was reaching out, and our analyst left NASDAQ. So the analyst that was overseeing our file had moved on, and the file was picked up by a new analyst who had to start over entirely. Like, you can't make it up.
It's so cliche that it's like, of course it is. Yeah.
And I was like, okay, it's fine. Like, surely he left some sort of notes or something there that we're good to go.
Handover doc, zero. And he's no skin in the game then. He's no understanding of Gareth. He's no understanding the history, or he or she is picking it up going, oh, good, more work.
Yeah. So it's at this point now where it's taking forever. So we hired a consultant that basically helps with listings, and we told them to just look in and kind of provide a bit of a push and see what you can do. And I remember I was actually home in Dublin at the time, and I was out in Howth, and I get a phone call from this consulting firm, and she said, it's not good news. And I was like, what do you mean it's not good news? I mean, the analyst said everything was fine. And she said, they're going to reject the listing because they don't like the SEC issue. I was like, this is what we dealt with last year. I mean, this is like, we were told to go away for a year, serve our time, deal with our penalty. I
mean, keep your nose clean, come back in a year.
Yeah, I mean, I was like, I'm pretty sure this is called like double jeopardy. Like, this is a legal like argument now.
Can't be tried twice. I love it.
And so she basically said, no, I agree with you. I think it's just a case that we have to argue it now. It's not going to be as smooth as we thought. And so we went from, you know, hoping to list in April to an eventual listing in October, arguing our case and escalating it. And it got to a point basically in end of September where she said, look, good news. They've green lighted the listing. You're good to go. Get everything ready and file to go in the morning. And I was like, brilliant. Here we go. And so we get everything ready to file and we just missed the cutoff. I can't remember what it was. It was like the audit documents were signed late or something like that. And so I have to call her back and I was like, you're going to have to call NASDAQ and tell them we're not ready. We need another day. And she was like, are you serious? Like, after all that, you guys are the ones that can't get it done now? And so we just couldn't get it structurally
done. What, you have to get it done a certain time? Or how does that work?
Well, she basically said they want you to list tomorrow, get all the documents over, but there's so much to pull together in a short space of time like that. And we were ready to an extent. But
do they list all throughout the year or do they list at certain times or how does it work?
They'll list you in most cases the morning of a certain day. So they'll just have you, you'll just appear.
Oh, basically. So they're listing companies all the time?
Yeah.
But they just slotted you in for this day?
Yeah.
All right, okay.
And so we pushed it. She was like, they'll be fine to push it to another day, but they're not going to be happy about it, but it'll be fine. So we pushed it to October 1st. And I remember we have the bank ready to go. We have the money ready to be invested. We raised $6.6 million at this point. This was more money than we'd ever seen in the company bank account.
How do you mean raised?
So we had an investment bank. So we didn't just do a listing on the NASDAQ. We did an uplisting with a consecutive fundraise. So we did a Wall Street type raise of $6.6 million at the same time with an investment bank.
Okay.
And it funded the company to really get stuck in and started now with our Aversa Tech.
Right. Okay.
And so...
And were they funding you on the basis of, look, they're going to be NASDAQ listed soon?
It was the same day as the listing. So it was contingent on a NASDAQ listing.
Jeez.
So the money would not hit the account until we were listed on NASDAQ. So it all happened kind of consecutively. On that same day. We listed on the NASDAQ on October 1st and we got funded $6.6 million that same day.
Big day.
It was a great day.
Lift shift cancelled for that night.
Yeah. I remember,
that's
I just remember
mentally
seeing the
hard.
Stock. Yeah. Yeah. I remember just seeing the stock kind of just like this, like all day. And I watched it like it was a movie for 8 hours, just moving, just life was in it, you know.
What happens on the day you're listed on the NASDAQ?
It's quite underwhelming, actually. I mean, it's not for you as a person, but there's no balloons going off. There's no nothing. You just appear. You're just there all of a sudden. As
what did you
company.
Do?
I sat there like a Cheshire cat all day. Like,
where?
Smiling. In our, my wife's an interior designer and she was working on a project in Florida and I was just sitting in the house that she was working on their Wi-Fi. Just watching.
You're
the show.
You're joking me.
Yeah. There was no big party.
After all
there was
that.
No nothing. Yeah.
Oh, you're killing me. I assumed like 5-star hotel, everyone like throws this big thing. He's the man. Come on in, Gareth. Like that's, we're gonna pull up like the curtains and you just walk out, hands in the air. Here I am.
That,
we did
that
it.
That was the bell ceremony.
Okay, that's so what I had in mind. What's the crack with the bell ceremony? Like is that's later or different to what?
So you have to kind of apply for that. And we put in an application, they you know, reserve time slots basically. And it's usually probably a 6-7 month wait because there's so many companies that want to do it or there's charities that do it and just...
Surely that's the whole point.
Yeah.
Ring the bell.
Right. And then, so we got our name down anyway and I was thinking maybe we'll be able to ring the bell like March, April, maybe it'll be a nice time to do it. But we were also in this period where COVID was kind of on and off, lockdowns were on and off.
This is what, 21?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the bell ceremonies were being done over Zoom.
Oh, that's so lame.
I can't do that. Like, if they ask me to do that, I'm not doing it. I want to stand on the same stage that, you know, Elon stood on and all these big people and press the same button. And I want that.
For sure.
If it takes a year to do it, that's the way we want to do it.
Environment matters and optics matter. You have to be seen to be up there. If you're just appearing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not the same.
But the way it worked out, they actually had a cancellation for, it was the end of October. The beginning of December, December 3rd, they had a cancellation and it was a Friday. And I got a call on the Wednesday from the, you know, marketing guy at NASDAQ and basically said, we've had a cancellation. Do you want to open the bell on Friday? And without even thinking, I was like, yep,
of course,
no problem. I'll be there. And he was like, perfect. Okay, we'll have you down for 9. And then I was like, I'm going to have to call everybody now and get them to New York.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And so I start first person I called was my mother, and I just called, and, you know, she was in Dunn's or Marks and Spencer or something, getting like bread and milk. And I was like, what are you doing? And she was, you know, she said, oh, I'm just picking up the messages for the week.
Doing and the big,
like,
shop.
Yeah. And I was like, well, just put it back. I need you to go to the airport in 4 hours and go to New York. And to be fair to her, she just went, yeah, all right, no problem. And put it back. And
then she's probably had worse phone calls from you, in fairness.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't asking her for rent, which is nice. But, you know, they basically went home, packed, and flew out to New York, you know, that evening or whatever it was. It was literally like they had to be at the airport in a matter of hours. And then get to New York. And I called my brother. And my brother was like, unfortunately, was tied down with something else. But he managed to come out just after the ceremony, unfortunately. But he was there for the celebrations. And then I called, you know, obviously called Heidi, and I called the rest of the team, and I just said, everybody who can be in New York on Friday, like, be there, because we're ringing the bell. It's real. It's happening. Like, you know, and, you know, even Heidi's parents flew out, and everybody, I was able to get most people there, which was great.
That's
and
amazing.
It turned into just such a celebration. And like, that was just the, we're in the club now. That was the, like, the organization that had rejected you twice now has your face up on their banner. You know, and it was just a real nice kind of like full circle moment through it all.
What does that mean then for you and the company? Because you hear about this all the time. So-and-so are listed on the NASDAQ. So-and-so are listed on the NASDAQ. And you see the photo, you smile and ring the bell. What does that mean materially? So you did a raise.
Yeah.
Simultaneously. So we know about that. But what does it mean, like, financially, materially to you and the company?
It's an overnight game changer. It's not even just financial. Your access to capital is ridiculous, basically, if you want to go that route. It's a phone call, it's a filing, it's, you know, 10 million in the bank type stuff.
Right.
Depending on how much hurt you're willing to take in terms of your equity. I mean, we never took that approach, but it's nice knowing that the access is there.
So you've now got the big tick beside your name, NASDAQ approved, blue chip, away you go.
Yeah, and it's the credibility.
Mm.
You, all of a sudden, you go from... Overnight, like, as cliche as that sounds, like, overnight you go from a company that people don't answer your phones to now they're calling you type stuff. You know, we're partnered now with Kendeva Drug Delivery, which is formerly 3M, which is a monster of a company. And these are the types of companies that don't give OTC companies the time of day, you know. But when you're NASDAQ, and when they research you, and when you know, you have a credible, liquid valuation, It's a different kind of respect level almost.
I mean, perception in business is so interesting. It's something I'm fascinated about because it matters so much. Me and Ben were literally having this conversation before you walked in about perception being a reality. Like, if you act like a big brand, you look like a big brand, and you've got a third party saying you're a big brand, suddenly people take you more seriously. I get better guests. I get better sponsors.
Yeah.
It's amazing in business as well. No matter right up the chain, suddenly... you're legit.
Yeah. And one thing I always say is you have to act like the company you want to become.
Yeah.
And when I was, you know, going back 10 years to 2012 and, you know, all the boxes in my mother's dining room, I had a website and I had like 4 different emails. It was like customer support at Nutriband and, you know, partnering at Nutriband. And it was all just coming to me. But it looked legit. It looked big. It looked credible. And it looked like the company I wanted it to become. So you have to have that mindset and you have to kind of manifest it almost. For that to become a reality. And, you know, basically we went from $100,000 investment to $100 million value last month. And it was manifested, though. I could see that the whole way through the lawsuits, through the regulator stuff, through, you know, the setbacks and everything. I always saw that ringing bell day.
Man, this is such a cool story. Yeah. Like, I'm just sitting back, like, I'm kind of, if you're watching YouTube, you see me, I'm just kind of sitting back kind of thinking about this is mad stuff. Like, this is... I don't think I've chatted to too many people that have had such a rocky road, but never deviated from the vision.
Yeah, it's important. I mean, if that's, you know, whenever I talk about it, I always go through a very quick 2012 to 2021 and talk about all the handful of positives. And then I say, but that's not an entrepreneurial journey. Now let me give you 40 minutes of the negatives, you know, and that kind of brings it to reality. And I think so many people, you know, if they take anything from my story, I guess it's just, believe in yourself and what you're working on. I mean, not everybody has to get it out the gate, but if you think you're onto something, I mean, right now, I mean, again, it's kind of a cliche, but we're going to be the first and only company in the world doing what we're doing. That, and it's nice because we're not only going to do well as a company, but we're going to save thousands of lives a year doing it. And it's very nice to feel that, you know, going to bed at night, that it's a game changer, essentially. If we get an FDA approval as planned next year, we'll be the only product on the market that has a technology in place, not only to make it difficult to abuse, but as a result, make it accessible to pain patients again.
Okay, so this is the product we talked about. Mm-hmm. There's a lad I deal with up the north. He also says he's quips, and I rang him last week and he was talking about like working together on something. He's like, Gary, you can do good by doing good.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, we often get asked, you know, why not charge more than you're planning to charge? And why, you know, what, take a traditional pharmaceutical approach and basically price everybody out of access. Mm. And my response is because we can't cannibalize the market if we do it that way. We're not coming in here to participate and be another player in the pain space. We're coming in here to revolutionize the safety profile and own the space. And I think we'll corner it entirely if we execute on our plan. There is no competition remotely close to where we are on a global issue, essentially, which is inadequate access to pain medication.
So you said the company's worth 100 million?
We hit 100 million in January.
Wow, what a landmark. And then what brought you back to Dublin?
Dublin was always, you know, Dublin's always home. I just lived in America, right? So, you know, it was always part of the plan to move back home eventually. And, you know, I'm coming home with a wife and a daughter, and it just feels like the right time. And not only just for us as a family, but, you know, the business itself, what we're working on with Nutriband isn't an American issue, right? Pain is a global issue. So we have patents now in 46 countries, including Ireland, including the EU, UK, all major markets in the world. So it's a, you know, it's a good time for the company as well to start expanding internationally our focus, because we're so close to that kind of FDA filing date that we need to start making sure that we're ready to move outside the confines of the FDA. I mean, this is a global problem.
It's a beautiful full circle moment here. Like, it's, Ireland is having a weird moment in terms of a lot of negativity around like Europe and innovation and Ireland and innovation and struggles. It's amazing to hear a founder of your caliber coming back and saying, yeah, I can run hopefully a multi-billion dollar company from here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the impact that we have as a country for of our size on the global scale is huge. And we're not short of talent. We're not short of ambition, or, you know, we're not short of support. So Ireland's as good a place in the world, in my opinion, to not only start a company, but to bring it home. So it was always, you know, it was always in the back of the mind. That's kind of just where we are today. It's just the timing.
I think it's an amazing, it's great to hear that, because, you know, bad news gets a lot of clicks and people tend to propagate a lot of bad news. Whereas on the pod, I like to focus on positivity. Mm-hmm. I like to focus on, well, what are we doing right?
Right.
Like, what are we actually doing well? Obviously, we can always do better, right? But like, it needs people like you. And we chatted about this briefly off camera about the startup ecosystem. Like, has that changed since you left, you reckon?
I think so. I think we're quite supportive of each other. I think the systems that are in place are great. I think they only work when you have an environment and a talent base that kind of flourishes. You can have all the support systems you want, but if you don't have ideas and you don't have people that are willing to gamble and take a risk on their ideas, then it doesn't matter. And I think that's what's really grown since I left, is that the entrepreneurial kind of spirit is huge. I mean, I speak at DIT quite frequently, or TU Dublin, as it's now called, quite frequently, and the ideas that is coming out of there alone is just amazing. So I think we're in very safe hands on the next generation of entrepreneurs, having the support systems in place to make sure that they have the best opportunity is great. So I'm sure, you know, there's going to be plenty more stories of companies that are coming home, not just leaving as well.
I think that's amazing. It's amazing to hear that, because it's amazing, because you do hear of like, oh, they went to San Francisco and they met it. And you're like, yeah, but we need to grow them here. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also, this is the first time I've spoken to someone who's coming back to keep growing it here. Like, that's cool. Usually it's like, oh, we went to America to grow further, blah, blah, blah. It's great to hear, like, the world has changed so much that now we can bring people back.
Enterprise Ireland helps to support and fund a vibrant startup ecosystem. providing supports, insights, and network connections to the most ambitious Irish startups. From expert advice to raising funding, exploring opportunities in international markets, to strategic planning, Enterprise Ireland is here to support you in those important startup moments. For more information about how Enterprise Ireland can support you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Enterprise Ireland, helping Irish startups go global.
Right, quick fire round.
Yeah.
What book should every founder read?
It's probably an unpopular answer, right? I am not a big book reader. And it's like an uncomfortable one because this is a question everybody gets asked. What book are you reading lately? What book are you reading? I'm not really reading a book right now.
Okay.
In my free time, I like to just research ideas and companies. And, you know, I'm reading Google, basically. I'm not really reading a book. And that kind of comes back to my college days. I was never a book learner. I learned from experience and I learned from, you know, ups and downs, and I learned that way. So, you know, the last book I read was the chairman of the company, Sergey. He wrote a book and I read that because, you know, I had a duty to, and it was interesting.
Kind of have to after all he's done for you, to be fair.
And it's nice to relive the story and what we went through together. But also, you know, there was more in there I didn't know about him, which was interesting. But I don't read a lot of business books. What we've done isn't in a book. Maybe it'll be in my book someday, but I'm not really reading one.
Love that.
Yeah.
Good answer. My own book when I write it. If I give you 10 million euro today, what would you do with it?
10 million?
10 million.
I think we're still at the very early stages of this AI revolution. So I would diversify it, I think, among opportunities within that space. Would need a bit of research on where and how that goes. But I think I'd be more focused on the early stage disruptive ideas that you start to see coming out now rather than the established players, for example. I mean, everybody can throw 10 million euro and collect 7% a year. But if you want your 10 million euro to become hundreds of millions, you have to be a bit risky. And I would say I have a high risk profile when it comes to investments and things like that.
I think after the last hour and 20 minutes or so, I think we all agree.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would say I'd dive a little deeper into that. One person that I work with, you know, her name is Emmy. She's starting a company now and using AI to have a positive impact on climate change. So I like companies that, you know, have a social good as well. I would definitely throw $1 million or €1 million at my brother and I wouldn't even need to know what he does with it, but he's kind of the mad tech scientist that would just know what to do with it. Like he was into Bitcoin when Bitcoin was like 13 cents, you know, he's this type of tech understanding that I don't understand. So I just kind of do what you need to do and I'll just collect when it's ready with him.
Because you answered my next question. I was asked, how do you invest a million? But you've kind of given me the answer there. Yeah. So on the topic of investments, what's been your best investment?
My best investment? Again, it's probably a cliche answer, but my best investment was just the team around the company. You know, every acquisition we've done, we kept the team on. We didn't try and cut salaries. We didn't try and cut them out. And that was an investment, you know, at a time when we didn't have a lot of money. We found ways to make sure people were paid. Just investing in the people around you, I think, is important. Everybody can invest financially, but can you invest in a support system? It's quite difficult to do and do it successfully. So I would probably put a lot of value on that more than anything.
What's been your worst investment?
Worst investment? I'm down quite a lot on Amazon right now. But that might rebound.
That'll rebound.
Worst investment, I would say, probably the acquisition in Ohio. From a financial spend to recoup those shares, basically. But again, I mean, I'm a big believer that there is real no bad investment. There is no failure to me is more like feedback. You kind of take from it what you can and you use it to your advantage. So although, you know, it was a terrible investment at the end of the day, learn so much from it. And you have to turn the negatives positive to keep them, you know, your sanity almost through stuff like that. So I don't really like to focus on negative investments. I don't know if there necessarily is any, because there's always something you can take from it, even as a learner.
It's a framework, right? Everything is framing in life. Yeah, you can reframe everything.
You have to stay positive. That's the thing. I mean,
what do you believe that other people would find weird or strongly disagree with?
Just in general?
Yep. Anything.
Like not just business related or?
anything in the world. Anything. Our most popular one is a conspiracy theory about Google Maps, which turned out to be true. So go for anything you believe that other people will find weird or strongly disagree with.
And there's always the flat earth stuff, but I'm not saying I believe in it, but I don't know. It's a good question. It's a tough one to answer, actually. Something that's weird.
Have a think as I ask you in the next one. We'll circle back to it because it's a good question. I'd like to get a quirky answer out of you. If you were starting again in 2025, what would you do?
I would save 3 years waiting to ask for help. And I would just do it out the gate and get feedback and advice and try and get people behind you. I would be, you know, learning what I learned, I guess, starting over. I would be in a much better position to gauge people and read people. I think that's really important. It's like I can spot a BSer from our first conversation, our first sentence now, right? I've become an expert at that.
That is invaluable.
Yeah. And that's something I didn't have. And that's obviously comes out in the story through the, you know, naivety of it all. And I think that's quite invaluable, not only just from getting into relationships with bad people, but the time you save by not doing that. I mean, there's years in our journey that can be directly attributed to just being with the wrong people. So I think that's very important. And then also just backing yourself and believing yourself. It doesn't matter if you're in a room full of people that are more experienced than you and things like that. I mean, that was something that took a while for me as well. Like when we did our first road show in New York, for example, you have to almost fight the fact that the overwhelming feeling is that you're not worthy of presenting to an investment bank on Wall Street, right? But you are. Otherwise, you wouldn't be there. So you just have to fight your internal thoughts a little bit and make sure that you feel like manifest again the person you want to become. You have to act like that out the gate. And these are all things I learned over the course of 10 years. This took a minute. And I'm still learning every day. You know, every year we go through lots of highs. There's always some little takeaway I'll have that I'll say, okay, I won't make that mistake again.
I like that. Like, yeah, you do have to act like the person you want to become, because I made that mistake for years of like, oh, when I do this, I'll be more confident. When I do this, I'll have more whatever self-belief or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's just tiny decisions every day, isn't it? There's no magic moment for suddenly comes along, puts the hand on the shoulder and goes, now you know what to do.
Yeah.
It's just... Not, and it's not faking until you make it. They're two different things. It's more just like acting like the person you want to become and the person you admire. I often look at that and go, I admire that person. I need to take a little bit of their traits, whatever that is. So I ask people, what's their founder formula for success? You're kind of a science guy, right? Mm-hmm. So what would be the kind of components you'd go X plus Y equals success? Like, what are the kind of key ingredients you believe that every founder should have?
Resilience, I think. Out the gate, I think don't expect a smooth ride, and I think almost welcome the rocky road as well, because I think it basically just builds character. I think if we had a smooth ride to the NASDAQ listing, I wouldn't value what we have in the same way, if that makes sense. Like I'll always put a value on a dollar or a euro or whatever it is now, because I've been in a point where that was a lot of money. And, you know, now we have 100 million of them. And that's not lost on me, you know? So I think resilience is one. I think self-determination, self-belief is two. And the last component I would say is kind of a modest maturity and not feel like you can't ask for help or ask for advice or ask for guidance. I think a lot of founders get caught up in the same sort of mentality I did, where you think you can do everything. And it's only when you have that little talk with yourself that maybe you're not as smart as you think you are. Surrounding yourself with smart people is the smartest thing to do.
I like that. Final question. What's your final piece of advice for every entrepreneur or aspiring entrepreneur listening?
Go for it. Just go for it. If it doesn't work, there's lessons to be learned in it. If it does work, it works, you know?
I mean, you list on NASDAQ.
Yeah. I know, I talk to students about it, and, you know, one thing to take away is that if you have an idea and it fails catastrophically, you're still in your 20s. You know, you can still go get a job somewhere. You can still have this as an experience that you've had, or you can try some, like, I'm baffled by the amount of founders and startup companies, you know, that were started by people in their 50s. You know, there's no limit to it. And I think just go for it. You only live once. And that's, you know, that's something I always think about. Like, you could be hit by a bus tomorrow, or you could be like, at the end of your life, are you going to look back and be disappointed that you had a failed attempt, or are you going to be disappointed that you don't know the outcome? That's kind of the reality of it.
To want to live a life of quiet desperation.
Yeah. Question nothing at the end, basically. Have a go at everything.
What a way to wrap. Where can people learn a little bit more about you and the company?
Nutriband.com. I'll give you a great insight on the company. I'm, you know, trying to be more active now on LinkedIn, Twitter. I'm sharing updates. We've had a couple of articles in the Times and the Post recently, which will give you a good idea on what we're doing as a company. But
so to find you on LinkedIn, who are they looking for?
It's Gareth Sheridan, NTRB, and that'll keep you updated on everything, you know, from a professional standpoint. If you want the unprofessional stuff, you can look at my Instagram as well.
Gareth, that was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Gary.